Welcome to Tennessee Court Talk. I'm your host, Barbara Peck, and today we are talking about appointed criminal work pursuant to Rule 13. This podcast is intended for attorneys. And my guests today are Lacey Wilbur, who is an assistant general counsel for the Administrative Office of the Courts, and Amy Park, who's our support analyst who works with Rule 13 attorneys. Welcome to you both.
Welcome. Thank you.
So first, Lacey, under the Constitution, defendants have a right to an attorney in specific criminal and even some non-criminal cases. And much of this work is done by the Public Defender's Office, but not all of it. So how do attorneys who want to do appointed work from the courts in criminal cases, how do they get involved?
We're going to talk about Rule 13 when we're saying Rule 13. It's Tennessee Supreme Court Rule 13. And so Rule 13, Section 1 gives you a breakdown of all the cases that are covered with funding under Rule 13. So criminal court, and once you've been charged, even contempt, child support contempt proceedings. And so if you want to start doing these things, and it's a great thing for new attorneys to start doing, the rule requires the courts to keep a roster of attorneys. So new attorneys, practicing attorneys, they just need to go to the court or the court's assistant and ask to be put on the roster. And sometimes attorneys just sit in the courtroom and wait and just raise a hand if the judge says, does anybody want to take an appointed case? So those are the main ways.
Great. And what sort of information does an appointment order have or need to contain for an attorney to take a case?
There are five things to make a valid appointment order. And so you need to have the style of the case. So it'll be state versus defendant. So you need the client's name. You need the case number. You need the judge finding that the client is indigent. You also need a statement appointing the attorney. And then you need the judge's signature. It can't be a clerk or an assistant who signs a letter saying you are appointed. It has to be the judge's signature.
Okay. And where do you get that appointment order from?
Different courts do it differently. Some judges have their own appointment orders and they'll just send them out to you. Others have you, the attorneys, create them and just submit them after you are notified that the judge is going to appoint you to a certain case. So it just kind of depends on the judge's preference.
Okay, so once an attorney gets appointed to a case, how do we know they're going to get paid from the AOC?
Rule 13, Section 1 lists the cases and the types of cases that will be paid. If you do not see what you've been appointed for on Rule 13, Section 1 and 2, call us. Give us a call, and we'll tell you whether it's covered or not. But if it's not in the rule, it's most likely not going to be provided funding by Rule 13.
So, Amy, let me ask you, so you're at charge. What is ACAP?
So ACAP is the AOC Claims and Payment System. It's how you need to register there after you get your appointment. Or even before you start taking appointments, you need to register with ACAP. You need to have an ACAP account. And you can do that by going to tncourts.gov and clicking on programs, going to the indigent defense page, and you will see, click here to log into ACAP. It's going to take you to the ACAP login screen, and you can click the little link there that says register for ACAP. You can also, if you have trouble with that, you can email acap@tncourts.gov and I will respond, or someone will respond with a link and how to do that. So if you have any questions, please just go to acap@tncourts.gov, send an email, and I'll be glad to.
And what's the purpose of ACAP?
ACAP, the purpose is to, you will go there, you will register, you will go and create your claims, you will put in your hours, you will put in your appointment order that she's talking about, you will put in your receipts. I do trainings and I can help you do all this, navigate through this till you get comfortable with doing it. That's really the purpose, is that's how you're going to get paid. You're going to have to put your claim into ACAP system.
And when I go to set up my account in ACAP, is there anything I should have in front of me, like banking information or anything, or is it?
You're going to be sent that. Once you do your online registration with ACAP, you will receive an email that has a W-9, and we need to get that back. You can email that back to acap@tncourts.gov. Please do not electronically sign it. You must physically sign it. scan it back, send it to us, and we will get that to FNA. It takes at least 10 business days to process. Then we send you a username and a password, and you can log in.
And I just wanted to follow up that Amy is an awesome trainer, and she does one-on-one training sessions, and she has this ability to actually, with your permission, take over your computer, and she can move your mouse around, and it's super helpful. And the people who have taken it said, why didn't I do this earlier? So I highly recommend that.
And once you set up your ACAMP account, you have to do it again if you get a different case, or is it?
No, it's one time set up forever. So if you're not a brand new attorney and you think you might have submitted claims in the past, either on paper or using our old ICE system, you do not need to register again. So definitely get in contact with me by going to sending an email at acap@teencourts.gov, and I'll check and just see if you have an old registration that we can update. You won't need to register again.
How much is an attorney going to get paid?
Rule 13, Section 2 sets the caps, and what type of case and what court you're in generates the cap. So a felony in general sessions court is going to be less than a felony in circuit or criminal court, and those are all listed in Rule 13, Section 2.
Is there a cap, like an hourly cap, or is there a cap like for the total case amount?
It's a dollar amount. So you get $50 an hour, but then your cap is going to be, say it's $3,000. It's a felony in criminal court. It's $3,000. You also get reimbursed for your expenses. So you're going to have a $3,000 cap, but you can also get paid all of your expenses and go above the $3,000 because the cap is only for your hours worked.
Okay. And what if I feel like there's a case that I'm just, it's way over the cap. Is there a way to get paid above the cap?
Sure. There's something called a complex and extended motion, and that's in Rule 13, Section 2E1, capital E. And I'm getting really specific here because that subsection gives you the magic words that you need to put in your motion to the judge. And please just, if you don't hear anything else, the judge needs to sign the complex order on or before the day you submit your fee claim. If the judge signs the complex order after you submit your fee claim, you will be capped at the regular amount. You will not be paid at the complex amount. So that's very important, and I just really wanted people to get that.
So is it, it's not really, though, the submit date? I thought that it was when the judge approved it.
It says contemporaneously.
Okay.
The rule says contemporaneously. And that wording comes from when they did it on paper, fee claims on paper. So they would submit their complex motion at the same time they submitted their fee claim to the judge. And the judge would look at the fee claim and go, okay, yes. And so that's what that is. But because now it's electronic, the judge needs to see it before you submit your fee claim, because ACAP requires you to have a signed complex order when you submit your fee claim, because you're going to hit complex in ACAP, so it will route properly and you can get paid at the complex amount, and ACAP requires you to upload the signed complex order at that time. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, okay. That does.
So what kind of cases are considered complex?
Obviously, first-degree murders, cases, and it also is the word extended. So it's not just complex. It's complex and extended, and it could be one or the other. So you have dependency and neglect proceedings that can take years. And even if though they're, and I hate to say run-of-the-mill, but if it's just a regular, ordinary dependency and neglect phase one, but it takes years, go ahead and submit that complex motion and order to the judge. And most of the time, the judges will agree and sign the complex order.
Okay, so the judge is the decision maker on whether the case is complex.
100%. It is not the AOC. It is
okay.
The judge.
Good. And then you mentioned expenses. So what kind of expenses do you mean? Do you mean like not my pencil? You mean mileage? Like, what? Give me some examples of expenses.
Sure. Expenses are covered in Rule 13, Section 4. And there's two different parts, and there's 4A and 4B. And this is very important. 4A are expenses that do not require prior approval by the judge and the AOC. And that includes mileage, copies, photocopies, either in-house or out-of-house, like at Kinko's, long-distance calls, if you still do those, and
parking.
And parking, yes, with a total daily cap of $10 per day. And you do have to upload receipts for those. And the rule will tell you, this you need to upload a receipt for. Copies you don't need to upload a receipt for. You'll just say, I made 52 copies of this motion or this final order. Now, 4B is the one that will trip everybody up, and so I appreciate this opportunity to talk about it. 4B expenses are any expenses that are not 4A. So if you are incurring an expense such as a medical record, inventory, or a court reporter, those are the two biggest things. If you need a court reporter or you need medical records, 4B, you need to do a motion and order to the judge, and once the judge signs it, please forward the email, the motion and the order to indigentteam@tncourts.gov for AOC prior approval. If you incur an expense, a 4B expense, before you have AOC prior approval, the rule prohibits the AOC from reimbursing you for that expense. And we've had court reporters in thousands of dollars on doing a transcript from a DNN hearing, and the AOC could not pay it because the attorney did not get prior approval. So please hear me when I say if it's not a 4A expense, it will be a 4B, which requires prior approval from the judge and the AOC.
Okay, and give us that email address again where we're sending it.
Sure, it's indigentteam@tncourts.gov. That's our new catch-all email for all things indigent. If you have a question, if you have an invoice from an expert or an investigator or a court reporter, they all go through there, and just questions on, oh, can I get paid for this? We route everything through that. So we're trying to have it be just a one-stop shop for anyone.
So are my 4B expenses going to be uploaded into ACAP at some point, or are they always just going to go to the email?
So once you get, so say you want a court reporter and you get the judge and the AOC, I will email it back to you and you'll see my signature on there approving a certain dollar amount. Then you give it to your reporter. Your reporter prepares the transcript or attends the hearing, and then you'll get the invoice and all that. But if it's another expense that you incur, I'm trying to think right now. Okay, medical records. If you have medical records, you pay for them up front, but you've already gotten prior approval under 4B. You've got prior approval. So you would need to, when you are claiming that as an expense, you'll need to upload the order with the AOC signature to show that you had prior approval, and you will need to upload the receipt showing that you paid the invoice.
Okay, so in my case file for my specific indigent, I'm going to have materials coming from the judge, my appointment order, different motion approvals, and I'm going to have approvals also coming from the AOC.
Yes.
So I just have to have two files or put them together, but I'm going to have approvals and different important things coming from two different groups, one's the judge and one from the AOC, and it's obviously important to keep track of both in case, make sure you get them, and then in case there's a question later or something that you have, here's my prior approval from Lacey for my medical records or my court reporter or whatever. So what kind of expenses, Amy, get put up into ACAP?
So as she spoke, parking is one. People forget that parking receipt all the time. All these receipts and documents we're talking about must be PDFs too. You must have a way to make them a PDF. ACAP will not accept anything else.
So I can't take a picture with my phone?
No.
No TIFFs, no Word documents. Has to
no,
be
you got, you've got mileage. You've got, like I said, parking.
If you've got lodging. That's a 4A expense.
Yeah.
If you are in state, you do not need prior approval. You just need to do it at the, out of state travel is a 4B. And 4B specifically says out of state travel.
Okay.
But so long as you are within the state rate of lodging in state, for say you had to travel to go see your client in prison, just upload that receipt showing that you paid the bill, and we will reimburse you when you submit your fee claim.
Okay. So I can take a picture of my parking receipt, but I would need to convert it to a PDF. Which you can do with different tools. I'm not going to go into that.
Exactly.
They can figure it out.
I just wanted people to know that. You know, that,
don't,
that
don't
seems
send
to
the
be
JPEG,
a problem
or
sometime.
I believe if it's an iPhone, it's actually an HEIC file now, just to really annoy us and make life more difficult. But they can be converted to PDF, so you just need to figure out how to do that. And then you can just put them right into ACAP.
Right. And there is a spot that people have trouble finding to put their receipts, but it's on your claim and activities tab where you're putting in your hours. And again, I cover that in my training, but there is an upload receipt. Don't use the pre-approval button. Use the upload receipt button so that there's a difference there.
So, Lacey, what if In my case, I need experts and investigators. How would I get those approved in this process?
Sure. That is totally covered by Rule 13, Section 5. And the first thing I want to get out of the gate is that you need AOC prior approval in addition to the judge's signature before your expert or investigator can begin work. If you get just the judge's signature and you don't get AOC signature and then we get an invoice for $5,000, the rule prohibits us from paying that $5,000 invoice. So I just, please get AOC prior approval. Those investigators and experts who work frequently for the AOC rates, they know and they will probably tell you, but we do still have new people all the time and sometimes it just falls through the cracks. But please get AOC prior approval before your expert or investigator begins work. And so the biggest pitfall on Rule 13, Section 5 is, oddly enough, people forget to put that their client is indigent in the motion or order. So that's the number one reason why I have to return a motion or order. The second one is the bigger thing, and it's showing particularized need for your investigator or your expert. And you file these under seal, and so they're confidential. So the facts are so key to show a particularized need for why you need an investigator or an expert. So don't hesitate to throw in all the facts, because we will never disclose or divulge anything that you put in a motion and order for requesting for an expert or investigator. The one that comes to mind is when people want to get a psychological evaluation. They just say, I need a psych eval because I need that to be effective, an effective attorney. And no, that's not particularized need. The ones that will be approved with flying colors are those that say, my client has a history of schizophrenia and has been put in the hospital several times. At the time of this incident, he was having hallucinations. Currently, he is not understanding what I'm saying to him. And it doesn't need to be all of those. It could even just be one of those to show a particularized need for an expert to get that information. And the ones for psych evals, those are the ones that I can't approve on the most part. They're the ones I deny the most frequently because they just don't have enough facts. And it's facts. It's facts, facts, facts. So if you want a crime scene expert, tell me that there was a murder. Tell me that it involved a bloody crime scene and that they didn't find your client's fingerprint there, or that it shows self-defense. These are facts, and these are facts that show you have a particularized need for an expert or an investigator. And that's a real big hurdle, and it's a learning curve for attorneys, but once they get the gist of it, they know what the rule requires, and they get really good at it.
So give me some common examples of what kind of experts and investigators we typically approve.
Sure. The rule has a list, psychologists, psychiatrists, medical doctors who can be forensic doctors to talk about causes of death, pathology. We have approved accountants when clients are charged with fraud or theft of property or theft of services. We have the big one that's used all the time, and it's not in the rule because it's relatively newer, is forensic cell phone examiners or forensic computer experts. They are $195 an hour is their rate, and they are approved. And those also, it's a learning curve for attorneys to show a particularized need, because everybody right now has a cell phone. So just because your client has a cell phone doesn't mean you have a particularized need for a cell phone expert. So tell me that this is going to show that there was some animosity, some text messages or images on the phone are going to show animosity, which might support a self-defense claim, or that something was consensual because of the back and forth, those things. And I've had one where it was pornographic images, and he was saying he didn't download those because they were downloaded at a time that he wasn't in possession of his computer. Just facts. It just all relates back to the facts. So just because you have a cell phone does not mean you have a particularized need for an expert. And then the other experts, I think they're crime scene experts. Those are an accident reconstruction. Those are 115. Those are very common in DUI, and also when someone dies in a DUI accident, they want to see if there was something else other than the defendant that was the cause of that accident.
So how do you go about starting your request for an expert or investigator?
Are you asking who, where you go to find
these
people?
Is it through ACAP? Is it through motion to the court? Like,
It is a motion. So most people out there will have names of investigators or experts. I have names. I can provide them. We don't put them on a list on the AOC. I think it's because we don't want to be seen to be recommending anybody's services, because we're neutral on that and we don't vouch for the quality of their services. But I can give you, without a recommendation, I can give you names of experts and investigators. You have to have your expert or investigator within 150 miles of the courthouse. If you find someone outside, you have to show the reasons why you, what efforts you made to find someone within the 150 miles. So I think if you just ask a colleague who has done this a while, they can give you a name. I can give you a name. And you first need to ask that person if they will work for the Rule 13 rate, whatever is provided. If they say yes, they will give you probably an estimate because they know how long it would take to do that. And that's important because in the order, the judge has to approve a specific dollar amount. So it would be $195 an hour to do cell phone forensic examination up to $5,750. That's quite common. So you get your expert or investigator first. You put their information. You have to have their CV if it's an expert, or their license. If they're an investigator, that has to be sent along. And then do the motion, do the order. Once the judge signs the order, please email the motion, order, CV, and any affidavit to indigentteam@tncourts.gov, and I will review for compliance with Rule 13. And if it meets the requirements, I will put my signature on it with the approval dollar amount. Now, sometimes I will approve an initial payment amount, and this is true for all psychologists. We have a limit, an initial limit of $3,500. So if your judge approves $5,000, I'm going to approve an initial amount of $3,500, and then the expert just needs to contact me before they go over that limit, and I write that out in the approval. I say expert must contact AOC before going over $3,500 limit. So pay attention to the words that I use. I usually will make it very clear that I'm not approving the full amount, but if I don't, that doesn't mean that you can't come back and ask for the remaining funds. So if I limit it to $3,500 and then you have to go to trial, but all of that $3,500 has been used up, you still have $1,500 on that order. And so you just come back and say, we're going to trial, and I release the $1,500. It'll be a second signature on that order, but that will show prior approval, and we will pay the full $5,000 on that.
So what if I want a particular type of expert and it's not initially approved? Is there an appeals process?
There is an appeals process. Usually I will tell you what you need to do to fix your motion and order so that it will be in compliance with the rule. And like I said, it's like put an indigency statement in there or put an approved dollar amount. The judge has to approve a specific dollar amount. If it is something that you are just dead set on and you're like, this is right, I'm going to the mattress on this one, you just let me know. I will tell you when I get back to you and say this doesn't meet the requirements of Rule 13. I give you the option and I say you can appeal this to the director and to the Chief Justice. So it's an internal process, but we will get that before the director and the Chief Justice, and the Chief Justice's determination is final. And we also have to go through that process if you're asking for a type of an expert that we've never approved before and we don't have an hourly rate. It may just be you've met all the requirements except for the fact that we don't know how much the Chief Justice wants to set the hourly rate at. And so that will also. And we ask that you allow 2-week turnaround time on that. So just be aware of that timeline if you do want to take it to the Chief or if it's an expert that we've not approved before.
And give me some examples of, like, different kind of experts that need to go to the Chief for the first time, like, in the last couple of years.
Oh, my goodness.
Isn't there one about music?
There was a rap music expert that went to the Chief. There was, what did I just have? It was a field sobriety officer. He was a police officer for a long time and taught his state's academy field sobriety tests. And this defendant wanted to show that the officer did not do the field test correctly, and therefore they didn't have enough to arrest him and search his car. I think it was going to basically be used for a suppression hearing. And shoe print, we've had a shoe print.
Interesting. So with the 150 miles, if I like an expert who's more than the 150 miles and I've worked before, and that's why I feel like he's better or she's better for whatever reason, how do I explain that? Just in the detail? I just am asking for an exception to the 150 miles or how would that work?
The rule just says you have to set forth the efforts made to find an expert within 150 miles. It doesn't talk about, I prefer this person.
Or I think they're better. Like for some reason, there could be a fingerprint analysis within 150 miles, but I want this person because I think that they're different, better, their approach, whatever.
Well, there's only one fingerprint expert that I know of. And that
person that wasn't a good example then.
Beyond the 150 miles, but that does happen. Preferences, the rule really doesn't speak to preferences, but in those instances when you're like, this person has 30 years of specializing in this one small area that I really, really need, makes this person much more necessary, and I have a particularized need for this particular person. So to meet the requirements of the rule, you have to say, I tried these people, I tried this, but I want to go with this person.
And again, so this is going to be an example too. This is just an expense at the end of the day. So I am going to pay this person and then get reimbursed with all my prior approvals.
No, this is completely different. So okay. Experts and investigators, we will pay them directly.
Okay.
No, we pay them directly. And again, it's just really just important that prior approval, you should see the judge's signature, and then you need to see my signature. Then you can send it to your expert and investigator. They begin work. And then what we have a process, it's an auditing process. And you as an attorney are part of this auditing process. The expert or investigator will give you their invoice. And you just review it and say, this person did perform these activities that totals this dollar amount. You physically sign the invoice. And then you forward the invoice and the order with my signature on it to indigentteam@tncourts.gov. And they will process the invoice and pay the expert and investigator directly.
And is there a delay? So at what point do I submit that? When they do the work? Or let's say my trial is not for 6 months, but my expert has done their initial analysis.
Well, here's the kicker, is that unlike attorneys can only file one fee claim per case. Experts and investigators can interim bill. So we have some who submit invoices monthly, some who do it every 6 months, some don't bill until the very end of the case. They also don't have a cap like the attorneys do on fee claims. So if you're on a felony AB in criminal court and you've got a complex cap of $6,000, your investigator can go well above $6,000 on an investigation for a first-degree murder, and the rule is what the rule is on the cap.
They're just different. Yes. They do the bulk, like a psychological analysis does the bulk of it, does their whole report, they can go ahead and bill, and then 6 months later they come back and testify at trial, yes, they can bill separate, and, yes, and they may never get to trial because their report may say something that makes us not want to go to trial.
It's quite common for the psychologist to submit an invoice after doing the initial evaluation and then coming back if it does go to trial. That's quite
common. And I would think a lot of experts, the same thing, might do their initial report, and then if they actually come and testify, it's a separate bill. So.
And you can file motions for additional funds. So if your expert or investigator uses up the entirety of the dollars on the order approved by the judge and the AOC, file a motion for additional funds, and tell us what they did to use up the initial amount and then what activities remain to be done. It doesn't have to be super detailed. I just want to have something there as a steward of the state's funds to show why we are giving out additional funds. But those are totally allowed and quite common.
Good to know. Anything else about experts and investigators we should know?
No, just please get prior approval from the AOC.
Prior approval from the AOC and from the judge.
Yes.
Two-step approval process.
Yes.
So in an example format, like how often in a case are people logging into ACAP to log their hours or updates? Do people usually wait until the end? Are they doing it every time I have an hour, I'm in ACAP and logging? Just give me some
There's
examples.
Not a wrong way to do it. It's kind of what you want to do. I tell people, though, you can you can start all of your cases. They'll hang out there in the new status under your active work tab, and you can just go back in. And I think it's a good way to keep track of them and go in and add your hours. You don't forget anything. Because if you sit down one day and put in all your hours, and let's say you forget a whole month, and it's easy to skip a page in these DNN cases especially, and you submit that claim and we pay you, and then you realize it, we don't pay you anymore. We can't do anything about that. You've lost a whole month. So I think that's why it's good to start your claim and kind of go in every day. But people do it differently because some people have lots of cases. Some people get appointed once in a blue moon. So
it just depends. But you can go in there. So you have the option once you've opened your case. If you have a particular week, let's say you have a hearing on your appointed case on Thursday, you've worked on it quite a bit, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you've had some expenses, you can go in there on Friday and get everything uploaded without actually being, quote, done and submitting your case. You're just like, this is where we are. We did a lot this week because we had a hearing. Now it's going to be another month maybe before we come back to it. So you go ahead, you log your hours, you get your expenses before you lose your parking receipt.
Right, right. And you have enough information to start and save a case if you have an appointment order in front of you. You don't have to have a single hour that you've worked on that case. If you have that appointment order, I can show you how to create that claim. That's enough information to start your claim.
Okay, so you just start your claim and then it gets saved. And then you log back in. It's a month later, we've had another hearing, something has happened, we've got more work to do. They're going to be there for you on ACAP, all your previous expenses and hours, and we'll all be logged in there for you. And you can just continue to add to it until you're ready.
And there's, like I said, there's not a wrong way to do it. It's what you want to do.
Yeah, and the reason why Amy said if you skip a month, we can't give another payment. That comes from the rule. You can only submit one fee claim per case per court. So if you try to submit another one, that's called interim or duplicate billing, and that's not allowed by the rule.
Okay, so you can continue to update your claim, but you're only going to submit it one time, and then you have one shot. So you don't want to submit too early.
Right, you want to be very careful.
You want to be done, because once you submit, then the case is considered done. But if you miss something because you didn't continue, so maybe you can always save and just wait to submit.
Yeah, I think, does ACAP automatically save? Don't you have to hit the save button? If you enter an activity, can you just close out?
Or when you enter your claimant, when you're on the claimant activities tab and you are entering all your activities, every time you click that add button, it's like clicking save. If you see it add under hours or expenses, it saved it. But what she's talking about, I think, is you're talking about the properties tab where you actually put in the client name, the case number. If you go back to that tab and make any kind of change, you need to hit save. ACAP does not automatically save on the properties tab. Again, I know it's kind of hard to explain this, but I cover that in my training and,
I learned something. I thought you had to on the last activity.
No, you do not. If you're hitting add on the claimant activities tab, that is like hitting save. Yes,
okay,
ma'am.
But properties page.
But if you go back and go, oh, I have uploaded the wrong judge or that he's not a judge anymore, because that's going to happen, you change that judge, and you don't hit save before you go to the action button and say submit, it may not submit to that judge that you had just changed it to.
And we're talking about tabs, properties tabs, audit activity tabs. Once you get in ACAP and just look around at just the basics, you'll understand what we're talking about when we say tab. So it's not that intimidating.
So if I have a case that's long, several years, do I still always have to just submit once? No matter what. So I could be getting reimbursed from parking from 2 years ago.
Yes.
It's just, okay. So you just wait the once.
Yes.
But, Lacey, is there such thing as waiting too long to submit your claim?
Yes. Please hear me. You have 180 days from the date of disposition in which to file your fee claim. This is not 6 months. Don't count on your fingers, because if you count on your fingers, 7 months out of the year, you will be 2 days late. And you will miss out. We cannot pay it at all. And you'll get $0 on a case that you've worked on for years. So the question becomes, what is a disposition? And it's kind of a moving target. But for a good rule of thumb, it's your last in-court date where something happened that the judge entered an order. So that's going to be criminal circuit court entry of a guilty plea. That's a disposition. If you're in general sessions, a bindover, that's a disposition. Dependency and neglect, phase one, you're going to have the adjudication, and then you're going to have the disposition. The disposition ends phase one. And please feel free to contact us if you have any questions about what a disposition is. But if you go by the general rule of thumb that the last in-court date is the disposition, you should be golden. But again, please feel free to call us. I would rather you call me on the front end than try and get it worked in after the fact when you've submitted beyond the 180-day claim, because there's nothing that I can do or anyone that the AOC can do to pay a claim that was submitted beyond the 180 day.
And how often do you have to deny a claim because it's more than 180 days?
I do it every day, unfortunately. And that's why I'm appreciative of this opportunity to get this information out, because it really is upsetting to do that and have to talk to an attorney who's worked for years on a case and will not get paid.
So what if I appeal to the Chief Justice?
The rule does not give an appeal process for a missing the 180-day deadline.
Okay, so we've given some of the examples we've had have been fairly straightforward so far, but what if my client has multiple charges? Is that multiple fee claims? How do I determine the disposition on those? What happens with a multiple charge or a more complex case?
That's a very good question, and it does happen quite frequently that people will pick up charges. You'll be appointed to one defendant, and then they continue to pick up charges as you're representing them in the first ones. So Rule 13 says you can only submit one fee claim per case. And it's not really the legal definition that you see in opinions by the Supreme Court. It is, if you have a defendant who has multiple indictments against him and you're representing him on all the different indictments, but they are disposed on the same date in front of the same judge, you will have one fee claim, even though you have different indictment numbers. Now, let's switch over to dependency and neglect, because this is a question that's asked a lot. If you have a father who has one petition against him, but then picks up another petition for a separate child, but they are disposed on the same date in front of the same judge, you will have one fee claim. And but if you only have one petition, so you have one petition against, and there are multiple siblings, and the siblings are adjudicated on separate dates, you still only have one fee claim because you only have one petition. Did I make sense on that one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
To multiple petitions, multiple siblings on multiple days will get me multiple claims.
Yes, there is.
If any of those things are not true, it's only one claim.
That's perfect.
Okay, and the same thing with picking up charges. It's all going to be dependent on if it's before the same judge being sort of adjudicated at the same time.
Yes, and if they're like not particularly complex or extended, but by combining those into one fee claim is going to put you above the regular cap, you can submit a motion for extended and complex and say, I'm having to combine all of these into one fee claim, putting me over the cap. I ask that you declare this complex and extended. And the judges usually will do that because they understand.
So a lot of cases, just about every criminal case starts in general sessions and then moves to criminal or circuit court, the state level court. So is that move ending one case and starting another, or how does that?
Each court is a different fee claim, and I'm glad you talked about the differences between sessions. So you're representing client in sessions, there's a bindover. That's a disposition. Submit your fee claim. You are no longer that person's attorney of record because the case has concluded. And that's in the rule, too. It says you are attorney of record until the case is concluded or you're allowed to withdraw. So even though you represented them in sessions, it's not a guarantee that you're going to deal with them if there is an indictment. And so there's that period between the bindover and before an indictment is put down. The rule does not provide funding for that gap in time. So the funding for circuit and criminal starts again with the issuance of an indictment or presentment. But if you represent them at bond hearings in between general sessions and the indictment, the rule does not provide funding for that. And a lot of people just do it pro bono, which I think is wonderful, but the rule doesn't provide funding.
Okay, so I've represented someone in sessions. They've been bound over, so the case is disposed, so I go ahead and file my fee claim. If there's anything in between before they're actually indicted in circuit, then there is no payment for that. If I want to represent them again, I believe in their case, I'm just interested and want to do it again, then I have to go to the new judge in circuit / criminal court and get a new appointment order.
Yes, and most judges, for economy's sake, will see who represented the defendant in sessions and keep the same attorney. I don't know that you have to go to the judge and ask to be, or if the judge will just automatically do that. Each judge does things differently, but for the most part, if you represent them in sessions, the circuit or criminal justice court will probably appoint you again.
What if I don't want to be appointed?
That is up to the judge. The judge has the ability to appoint you. I don't know of any way to
let the judge know I don't want to be involved in that case. I mean, I could probably just send like a letter if it's, you know, I've taken on some private work that's just overwhelming or some circumstances changed.
Yeah, they're actually,
I can just say, I'm not going to be able to do this anymore.
Yeah, you're reminding me that in the rule, I think it's in Rule 13, Section 1, it says, the judge can appoint a private attorney unless the attorney shows it would be, I don't think it uses the word undue hardship, but it's something along the lines that you have such a heavy caseload that you can't take
Something has changed in between. Because some cases can take a while.
Yeah.
Like 6 months ago, I was in, you know, sessions and was ready to take on a case, but I'm not. So what if I'm a newer attorney and I'm in general sessions and I'm raising my hand, I want to do a case, and I do, I get appointed. Charges have been added. All of a sudden, this is getting very complex. The person is bound over, and I'm appointed again in criminal court, state court, but I'm feeling maybe a little overwhelmed that it's beyond me. Is that something that happens, or it's just get a mentor and go do your job?
I don't see that part of it. So I just see the fee claims when they're – so I don't see any of the – I don't want to call it drama, but any interactions between the judge and the attorney, and I'm sure those things happen. And I think exactly like what you say, a new attorney, and then you get into circuit or criminal court, and this guy all of a sudden has a capital case.
I thought I was doing some robbery. It turns out that someone has now died, and now we found something, and now we have a second degree murder charge or something. So you just have to.
I think judges, and this is totally personal opinion, but I think judges are very attuned to an attorney's ability and workload, and don't want to overload an attorney and don't want to overload the system.
Okay. So what happens to my fee claim after I have a disposition, I have filled out all of my work, I'm happy with my claim, I've got all my receipts in, all my prior approvals for my 4B claims, it's all ready to go, I'm ready to press the submit button, what happens to my claim then?
Once you submit the submit button, if it is a claim for over $400, it will go to the judge, and the judge will review the fee claim and approve it, or maybe reduce some time or return it to the attorney to say you're asking for too much for this suppression hearing. And then once the judge reviews it, it comes to the AOC, and we have AOC auditing staff, and they will review and they look for the five things on an appointment order. They look for the receipts. They look for mileage. On mileage, you have to give the starting city and the destination city. If you're not putting that in there, they'll return it to you. So attorneys get a feel for it in the end, but it's just judge, then AOC audit staff, and then once AOC audits it goes to F&A for payment, and I highly recommend direct deposit so you will get your paycheck much faster.
And when you say either the judge or the audit staff at the AOC, if they are sending something back to me, how am I knowing this? How am I getting sent?
That's a great question. So it's going to be in the returned claims tab, which is, Amy, is that?
It's on your active work tab. You have, if you're an attorney, on your active work tab, you have three columns: claims, return claims, and pre-approval. And you will not get any kind of email or any kind of notification that you have a return claim. You need to click on that return claim tab, and your claims will be there that have been returned to you. You can also view your return claims in the search tab. But if you open a claim in a search tab, it's in a read-only view. So you cannot edit that claim. You cannot submit it back. So you can see you have returned claims, but you cannot do anything with them. You need to be under the return claim tab.
So if I if I, you know, I submit my claims and then, I don't know, 2 weeks later, I want to go check on it. And I go to that return claim site, will I be able to see that it's been approved by the judge and has moved to the AOC? Like, what can I get that based? So I can see that. So
you can see all of that by opening up your claim and go into your history comments tab that's inside of your claim. Inside your claim, there's a history comments tab, and it will say why your claim was returned. You will be able to tell if it was returned by an auditor, if it was returned by the judge. You'll be able to see what day the judge approved it, what day the auditor returned it to you, those type of information, yes.
And I just want to add one thing there. If you add a comment back, like you want to say something on the claim in answer to somebody's question, when you add a comment, it doesn't go to any email inbox. It stays on your claim. So a lot of times attorneys are like, what's the status of this claim? And we never get an email, so it's better to email indigent team because the comment on the history comments just stays in the claim, and we won't see it until we actually get to the auditing stage.
Okay. So I can see if the judge approved it or the judge had a question or the judge denied it. So if a judge, you know, if I bill 30 hours and the judge thinks it was more like 20, is it automatic that it gets reduced to 20, or do I get to or is he waiting for me to approve the 20? Like, what happens at that point?
So you're asking if it's been returned?
It's been returned to the judge. I submitted it for 30 hours, and the judge has said, this is 20. This is 20 hours of work. What do I need to say? Yeah, okay, fine, I agree. Or is it just going to be automatically going to be reduced?
He's telling you, the judge is telling you, take it down to this amount, and I'll pay it. And resubmit it back to the judge. A lot of times attorneys will call me, or they'll call Lacey maybe, and say, why is the judge telling me? And I will tell them, you need to talk to the judge about this. I can't do anything about it. And I do tell them they can talk to Lacey about it, but she's probably going to tell them the same thing. But if the judge returned that claim to you, if he tells you to reduce something by 5 hours, then you need to reduce it by 5 hours and resubmit it to
Okay, so then I need to resubmit. There's a step for me. I need to resubmit it. I can't just roll my eyes and walk away and think that I'm going to get 20 hours.
And it's going to sit there and not get paid. But you need to fix it and resubmit it. Or if you want to put a comment on there back to the judge and resubmit it back to him, that's between you and him. But I'm not telling you to do that. I'm going to tell you to take that 5 hours off and resubmit it to the judge.
Okay, so then it gets resubmitted. The judge approves, not approves. I can see that in my history. And then it moves automatically to the AOC then.
Yes.
And I'll be able to see, okay, the AOC. So I'll know I made one hurdle. It's gone over the judge. The judge has approved my claim. And now the AOC has it. And they could send it back for. So if it's something like, I didn't have a receipt or something they questioned. Then what happens? Do I just take it? I don't have it. I mean, this is, you know, a parking receipt from 2 years ago. I meant to, and I did. It's gone now. So I just then delete that parking, or what happened?
So Lacey, do you know for sure if an auditor opened up a claim and there was a parking on there and there was no receipt? I think they just strike it off. I don't know that for sure.
Yeah, they usually don't return a claim just for parking, just because if you made that mistake, we're not going to send it back because we try to keep claims moving. But if it were, then yes, you would need to strike
that expense. If it was more significant.
If it was something like lodging or something.
My court reporter doesn't have pre-approval.
Yes.
Then that would be sent back. And I would have, if it's pre-approved, maybe, I don't know how I would make up for that because I didn't get it. Yeah. But if it's somehow I'm arguing I do have a letter from Lacey or something, I would have an opportunity to go ahead and fix that.
But it's the same thing. When a auditor returns it or when a judge returns it, you need to read that history comment. If you don't understand it, please call me or email the Indigent Teams box or the ACAP mailbox, and someone will get back with you and help you understand that message. But yes, you need to do something. You need to act on it, and you need to resubmit, or you're never going to be paid.
And so at this point, what is happening to my 180 days? Is it the 180 days, if I've submitted and I've gotten it back, is the 180 days still running, or is it because I've submitted once, it's okay?
Once you hit submit, the first time you hit submit, that stops the running of the 180 days. So if your initial submission was within the 180 days, if we return it to you and you don't see it for 6 months, and then you resubmit it 6 months later, it's still going to be timely because you originally submitted it within the 180 days. But, and this happens a lot. People don't check their returned claims tab. I tell them to check it at least like once a week or at least once a month, because we see claims that have been in their return claims tab for 6 months. I've seen a year. I've even seen 2 years. So just check that return claims tab.
Okay, but I do have the opportunity. Okay, so now, in my hypotheticals, what if you have a lot of appeals work? So I've gone with a client, I've represented them in court, we did whatever, but we want to appeal. Or I just want to do appellate work, how do I get appointed for appellate work?
Well, your appointment at the lower court, at circuit court, criminal court, or even in juvenile court for a DNN, that appointment order will follow you all the way up to the Tennessee Supreme Court. So you do not need to get a new appointment order at each stage at each court, because the rule says you are appointed to represent that client, including all appeals, or until you are allowed to withdraw. So you are the attorney of record until it's finally closed after an appeal. And that brings up another thing is that, you know, each court is a separate fee claim. So if you've got your trial court and your jury verdict has come down and you want to appeal, the jury verdict, your notice of appeal is the disposition. Submit your fee claim within 180 days of the notice of appeal. Some people wait until the Supreme Court issues a mandate, and that is well beyond the 180 days because that's a separate court. So if you go to the Court of Criminal Appeals or Court of Appeals, any appellate court, the disposition date is the date the court issues its opinion. It is not the mandate. And that's another thing that's a big hurdle. And we also have instances, if a case is remanded, you start a brand new criminal case or a brand new DNN fee claim starting at $0. So you get a whole other fee claim and you're not just stuck with your initial fee claim and can't do anything else. It's a brand new fee claim if it goes back down on remand.
Okay, so started in general sessions, we were bound over. I have a fee claim.
Yes.
With the cap. Then I've been appointed by the criminal court. We've gone through a trial or whatever we did. We have a disposition by the trial court, and we filed our notice for appeal. That is a disposition. That's my fee claim there. I go up to the Court of Appeals. I get an opinion from them. That is a disposition. That is my third claim for this case. They remanded. I go back to the trial court. That is my fourth fee claim for this. And if I appeal again, that's going to be five. If I go to the Supreme Court, that would be six. Whatever continues. So it's ever building, and the 180 days is going to apply after each of those dispositions. If I'm like, I don't do appellate work or whatever, then I have to be able to withdraw, though. The rule is going to say when I can withdraw. I just can't decide lollygoggy that I'm not going to be the appellate lawyer here. I need to formally withdraw, and I need to be able to, under the rule, meet the qualifications for withdrawing. Yes. So you can't just, you are in it until.
You can't just walk away. You have
you
to
can't
have
just walk
the
away
order
and say,
granted,
I've gotten busy. It's been 3 or 4 years now. My practice is blooming and I'm
so
done.
You need to do this anymore.
You need to continue with your client. So what about capital cases? Let's talk about those a little bit. And what if I want to do appointed work for capital cases?
Okay. I think it's a phenomenal experience for attorneys to be able to handle capital cases. And the rule, and it's Section 3, it gives you requirements that you must meet to either be co-counsel or lead counsel. There's a separate hourly rate. But this is also important. In a non-capital case, there's only one attorney to get paid. So if you are on like a second-degree murder case in circuit or criminal court, and he appoints you, and then he appoints another attorney, only one of you is going to get paid. But in capital cases, there are two attorneys. There's lead, and then there's co-counsel. And there are certain requirements, as I said, and that's really listed out in great detail in Rule 13, Section 3. And if you meet those and you want to be on what we call the list for capital cases, we have, I think it's under webmaster at tncourts.gov, we have a form, and it's check the box. And if you check the box, it should show you whether you qualify as lead counsel and also show you whether you qualify as co-counsel. And you can also be qualified for post-conviction. So those are three things. And then you give us that, fill out that form, send it back to us. And I don't know what we do with it from there to get that information to the judges. But I know it's a list that the judges have access to.
For capital cases. So you mentioned something important there, so I want to go back to it. So you mentioned that there's only one attorney in a case. So what if I find out there is a second attorney has been appointed to a case that I've been appointed to? What should I need to work that out with the judge and make sure that I'm getting paid?
Hey, I can't give legal advice, but I would recommend that you go to the judge and say Rule 13 only pays for one attorney in this proceeding or this.
Yeah, especially now when you have a lot of new judges. So make sure that they understand there is only one. And then obviously, what if back at my firm, I have associates and partners and we sort of are working together on that case. How does that billing work?
It's the qualified attorney that is the only person who can bill for work. So if And Rule 13, Section 4, I think, specifically says you can't let your paralegal or your assistant charge for any activities or time that they do. So if you are working in capital case, you're qualified, you're working in capital case, if your paralegal is doing a ton of work, he or she cannot bill the AOC for that. You only, as the attorney, as the qualified attorney, can submit activities for payment.
And the same thing in a non-capital case. If I'm, working on a second-degree murder and I have my first-year associate do some research for me and do some work on that case, that cannot be billed to the AOC because it has to be my work.
Correct. And I've seen some people put activities about talk to my mentor. I think it's great that you talk to a mentor, but it really needs to be time spent on the case that you performed, not mentor time, but I highly recommend having a mentor in this system.
Okay, so what sort of pitfalls have we not touched upon that you think it's important that the attorneys know?
We hit on it, and I'm going to hit on it again, is 180 days to submit your fee claim. In the rule, it's Rule 13, Section 6A5. It has the words last activity, and that's what attorneys latch on to. Last activity, if you read the rule, is only applicable to dependency and neglect phase two proceedings. That's it. And so that's why a lot of attorneys are just like, I filed this letter with my, I sent a letter to my client, and that's the disposition. No, that's not the disposition. So please, if we learn anything, the biggest pitfall is the 180-day deadline. And I would just ask that be put out into the universe.
So let's talk a little bit. I mean, I feel like in part ways, we've made this sound cumbersome or difficult and like, why would you do this? But tell me, I mean, obviously, this is not what your role is, but talk just a little bit about, like, from an attorney standpoint, obviously, I know you practice at the Attorney General's office and you're an amazing attorney. So talk a little bit about the experience and the good that attorneys can learn from that can come out of doing indigent work like this.
You know, I get feedback from attorneys all the time, and they're like, I'm not in it for the money. I'm doing it, like the attorneys and GALs who do dependency and neglect, they're like, I'm doing this for the kids. I'm doing this for the families. And people who do it for criminal defendants are like, I'm doing this because it's part of justice, and it's how our system works, and this is very important work. And I think it's great for brand new attorneys to get a feel and start learning. And I've seen attorneys go from getting newly appointed in general sessions, and then in 2 years they're dealing with murder cases. And it's important work. It's good work. And I'll take this opportunity. The court really appreciates attorneys doing indigent work. They understand that this is a thankless job, but I think the people that do it and love it do it out of a sense of purpose and a sense of pride of doing something that matters. And I appreciate what they do.
Good. And Amy, tell me a little bit about the biggest pitfalls you see. Lacey has really pitched her 180 days and get your claims in. But from your standpoint, as more of the ACAP expert, what are a couple pitfalls that you really wish that you could get across to people they could avoid?
I want people to remember that you need to redact any personal identifying information from documents that you upload into ACAP. I don't know if we've touched on that here, but that is something that will get your claim returned. And people ask me all the time, what is personal identifying information? Lacey, do you want to talk about that?
Stuff you wouldn't want out there. It's your date of birth, your social security number, bank account numbers. We get 12,000 fee claims a month. And we ask that the attorneys redact before they upload so our auditors can just keep pushing the pedal to the metal and keep going through those 12,000 fee claims a month. And it has helped tremendously, especially with dependency and neglect proceedings. Our goal is to process and send fee claims to FNA within 30 days of receipt. We're not always on there. I think we're running at 6 weeks right now, but that is our goal. And I think once, give us a little bit of time because we're down two people in the finance division. Give us time to fill that, and we'll be back to the 30 days.
And we've made the 30 days before. Oh. Since we've launched ACAP, we have made.
I'm proud of that, too. They work really hard, and we were nailing it, and then just got some retirements that we can't fill.
If you want to come work for the AOC,
yes.
If you employment, tncourts.gov/employment.
Accounting. We need accountants.
Yes. We do.
You will. Anything else that you really want people to understand?
The only other question I get that I don't think Lacey touched on is when you're representing a client and you've turned in your claim, it's disposed, it's over, and he has a probation violation, do I need to get a new appointment order if I am still representing that client, or can I use...
That's a great question.
The old appointment order.
We ask that you get a brand new appointment order because that will help our auditor see a different date on the appointment order, because the probation violation is going to have the same case number. So what's going to happen is ACAP is going to flag it as a potential duplicate. That's just a label. Anytime you use the same case number in more than one fee claim submission, it's going to pop as potential duplicate. So if you get a new appointment order and it has different dates from that judge, it's going to show our auditor, oh, this is a probation violation. It's a brand new appointment order. It's not a duplicate. It's not interim. It's okay to pay. And so that keeps your fee claim chugging along. And you get people who have 4 or 5 probation violations, and you just, to help make your claim go through quickly, get a new appointment order on each of those probation violations for each of your separate fee claims. That's a good point. And the other thing is, how long does it take for, don't wait till the last minute to sign up to ACAP. Don't wait till the 180th day to register because it takes a while to register and get set up.
It takes 10 business days from when we get your W-9, we submit that to FNA, and that's if there's no problems with your W-9, everything's great. We can usually get you your user ID and temporary password within 10 days of getting your W-9. But you can go ahead and register, even if you're just thinking about it. I have attorneys call me and say, I'm thinking about doing some indigent work. I say, go ahead and get an ACAP account. Go ahead. I mean, so it's out there, and it'll just be there. You know, you might have to update your banking information if you change something like that. But that way you're ready to go, and you can get your claims in, and you won't have to wait, like Lacey said, and be calling and going, I'm up against the deadline, you know. I've got to get my ACAP claim in.
Who else uses ACAP besides attorneys?
Interpreters, investigators,
experts,
judges use it to approve claims.
Are all guardian ad litem attorneys?
Yes.
Okay. So as an attorney, you can choose to be an attorney on a case, and you can also choose to be a guardian ad litem if it's you have a different type of practice, you're not sure you want to be in the courtroom doing criminal work. Yes. Another way you can be involved is becoming a guardian ad litem, and you would still bill through the ACAP system. And a lot of the same rules we talked about today would apply if you want to do guardian ad litem work. And a large chunk of the work that comes through the indigent program is guardian ad litem work. So that's another really special program. If maybe criminal defense is not for you, that being a guardian ad litem is a different kind of work, and something that attorneys can really also work on, like it, as a pro bono type of effort, but you're actually getting paid at least
$50 an hour.
You paid something, which is better than
nothing. But we have the judicial hospitalizations, you know, the claim type also.
So there's other types of work in there besides pure criminal defense.
Oh, yes.
Is too. And the juvenile courts as well. I know juvenile courts are very
delinquency
in cases,
DNA,
so
termination of parental rights.
Right. Usually people who practice in juvenile courts. Yes. So, but that could be an interest you take on the side, is you want to do some juvenile work, but not necessarily do. I think people think that everything with indigent has to do with adult felony or adult. You know, it's not even actually General Sessions. It's a huge part of that, but it's not all adult criminal work, criminal defense. There's guardian ad litem work, there's work in juvenile courts, so there is other programs out there other that you can sort of get involved and do some public service type of work, getting paid something, obviously not your full billable rate, most likely. But at least doing something for our state and something for the community.
And I just want to say thank you to these attorneys and guardians ad litem. I appreciate them, and it's a calling, and I appreciate that they do this for us.
Well, thank you both for joining us on this edition of Tennessee Court Talk.
Thank you.
Thank you.